also British, is Afghanian and Sierra Leonean parentage. Aidan Gillen, who plays Tommy Carsetti, the calculating politician, who on occasion gets passionately if momentarily swept up in his own rhetoric, is from Ireland. Some of the actors in The Wire are amateurs, and some are pros educated at Juilliard and Yale. Benga Akinagbe and Felicia Pearson, who play Chris and Snoop of the Marlowe Stanfield gang, are prime examples. Akinagbe is a professional actor and Bucknell graduate, and Pearson is a Baltimore rapper and quite literally an ex-con, having done time at the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women for a homicide committed when she was 14. She had never acted on screen before, but was brought to the set by Michael Williams, Omar, himself a former dancer, then placed prominently and without a name change in seasons 4 and 5. Her real-life nickname is Snoop. Together, Snoop and Chris form a duo that, according to Stephen King, are two of the scariest assassins ever put on the screen. Snoop bears a petty mime's pale impassivity. Chris's starburst hair gives him a clown silhouette, though his face remains stonily dour. Together, dour clown and mime, they are assassins in an escapee circus act, caught in a zombie script that would terrify not just Baltimore's finest, but Baltimore's finest horror writer. At the beginning of season 4, they buy a nail gun that Snoop suggests they use as a weapon. The screenwriters nod, perhaps, to Cormac McCarthy's cattle bolt. Snoop and Chris fill up abandoned row houses with the bodies of young black men, number one males in police terminology, who have in some way disrespected their boss, Marlowe, creating a charnel house straight out of Poe. No one is really looking for these victims. Oh, for a missing blonde cheerleader, think the cops, whose budgets have been slashed, reduced wages, no witness protection funds, flat tires on their cars, DNA samples going bad in broken refrigerators, and by the time the bodies are found, there are well over a dozen. "My number in the office pool is 23, says Detective Bunk, cigar in mouth, so convincingly played by Wendell Pierce. In the Barksdale gang, the Hopper, the Lieutenant, and the Deputy Kingpin, who are killed for going their own way, Wallace, D'Angelo, Stringer Bell, are portrayed by actors possessed of especially beautiful and sensitive faces. Their deaths play viscerally and haunt the show. Seasons 1 and 3 are largely built around them. Almost everyone a viewer might quixotically root for is eventually killed. Even if the killing is not lingered over, the show pulls no punches. Avon Barksdale initially seems green and weak next to the handsome and charismatic Stringer, but the several layers of Avon's manipulations are put forth with fluid skill by Wood Harris, and when we see him again in season 5, his performance has solidified into a nuanced affability made sinister by power. One of the series' most telling scenes is in season 3. When Harris and Elba stand on a terrace overlooking the city, anxiously disguising their characters' mutual betrayals with sentimental memories of a shared boyhood. Here Avon's extra layer of artifice, his hardened street soldier smarts, triumph over the man who would like drugs to be a business rather than a war. There is not a feeble performance in the entire show. While David Simon is achieving remarkable verisimilitude, supplying the scripts with a glossary and making sure the writing is both on message and real. Bitch is used mostly to describe men. Only black actors use the N-word and often affectionately. The actors sometimes improvise imaginatively, often with the prop and costume people, reaching for the curious displacements of art. Lance Reddick plays Lieutenant Daniels as a princely African-American Spock aboard the starship Baltimore. Robert Chu plays the drug lord, Proposition Joe, whose wistfulness for the old days is expressed in his tender repairing of broken clocks. One defiant and suspended policeman, Herc, played by Dominic Lombardozzi, whose Bronx accent is already a conspicuous and pleasingly unexplained dislocation, try not to think of Tony Curtis in Spartacus, defiantly opens his front door, wearing a Wisconsin t-shirt with the logo, "Smell the Dairy Air." Omar sports a long, waxed duster to accompany his shotgun and bulletproof vest, making him seem very much an urban Jesse James, and the lighting, editing, and quite self-conscious cinematography in various showdowns assist in this motif. In the one episode where Omar is on a Caribbean isle, he seems so out of place the storyline quickly summons him back to cowboy land. J.D. Williams as Terminal Corner Boy Bodie emerges as a tremendous actor, with or without his white do-rag, filched from a production of The Crucible. And the middle school quartet in season 4, Michael, Naimond, Randy, and Dookie, are a gut-wrenching ensemble. But Julito McCollum's performance as Naimond, replete with ponytail and earrings, seems singular in its range. His character is given more to do, but as an actor, he is there for every moment of it. His tears before his mother, his fury at the universe, his jokes with his pals. "Yo, you must be one of those at-risk kids," he says self-satirically to Dookie when his friend orders the turkey grease at a Chinese restaurant. All this makes Naimond's successful, if narrow, escape from the neighborhood one of the few bearable outcomes in The Wire's many stories, and one of the only times when reaching out to a cop doesn't result in catastrophe. It is a small statistic, as with the ex-con Cuddy's successful boxing club, but one of human escape amid hopelessness. As the ill-fated Dookie says, "How do you get from here to the rest of the world?" Tolstoy was wrong about happy families. It is more likely hell or hellishness that is of a predictable sameness. Heaven will take one by surprise, as surprise is perhaps essential to it. "Sometimes life just gives you a moment," says Lester Freeman, played by the deep-voiced, bow-legged Clark Peters, the gifted actor who has accompanied David Simon on his journey through The Corner, The Wire, and Tremé. But with this much already under Simon's and Peters' belt, beyond, as they might say shruggingly in Baltimore, ain't no thing. The series' final words are "let's go home," not unlike the last words spoken by the last man on the moon. 2010. Memoirs. It is hard not to be impressed with Fran Lebowitz's comedically acerbic dismissal of memoirs. When asked in the Martin Scorsese documentary Public Speaking whether she would ever pen one, she quickly replied that if your life were all that interesting, someone else would write a book about it. Despite having some sympathy with this idea, or with caustic wit, or with avoiding writing, one can nonetheless assume that there are good reasons to embark on a memoir. The world and the self collide in a particular way that only you, or mostly you, can narrate. You would like a preemptive grab at controlling the discourse. For instance, are you Winston Churchill? Are you Nixon in China? Are you Pat Nixon in China? Did you compose Nixon in China? Its composer, John Adams, has in fact written an engaging memoir. Are you connected to a fascinating and underexplored chapter in history in any manner whatever? Are you a professional storyteller with a beautiful prose style and some autobiography begging for reportage? Are you a trenchant thinker with incisive analytical powers? Do you have a social cause for which you would like to advocate strenuously? And if none of the above, are you Raquel Welch? If not, wherefore the memoir? Are you helpless before your own life and unsure of how to write the autobiographical novel that might exploit or explore or redream it into art? Do you have a case of what the literary critic Michael Wood has called catastrophe envy? Have you drunk the reality hunger Kool-Aid of David Shields's current pro-poetic essay campaign and anti-novel jihad, and joined him, as has the brilliant Rachel Cusk, in what sometimes sounds like chiding the limp dog of fiction as if it were an unfortunate habit of lying, an omnivorous pornography of the real, instead of the struggling but majestic thing that it is? Are you coming into the house of narrative through the back door, because the back door is where the money is? Are you prone to what a recent article by Neil Gensler in the New York Times Book Review suggested might be the oversharing of inconsequential you? Unremarkable lives should go unremarked upon, the way God intended, Gensler wrote in what reads like a reversal of the final lines of Middlemarch, George Eliot on a drink-addled day. That many young people are already writing their memoirs is no longer a funny thing to say, but an actual cultural condition. Book buyers have nudged publishers in this direction. We love to read memoirs. Why shouldn't we? At a dinner party is not the fiction which consists predominantly and unfortunately of abbreviated film plots, protracted jokes, and urban myths less mesmerizing than the real-life tales? It would be heartless not to be interested in memoirs. People are telling us their personal stories and speaking to us of their private lives, and even if this structure is rickety and the prose has, to borrow Dick Cavett's phrase, all the sparkle of a second mortgage, we are going to hang in there because it is true. That the facts and details of these jumbled confessions are occasionally fudged and embellished, however, seems inevitable, given the limits of memory and the demands of writing. There are many things a storyteller must add and subtract to tell a good story. Dick Cavett, himself a first-rate memoirist, became the prompt for Lillian Hellman's James Fry moment when in 1980 Mary McCarthy said on Cavett's show that every word in Hellman's memoirs was a lie. A lengthy lawsuit ensued. In 2006, James Fry had to account to Oprah for the fabrications in his memoir, A Million Little Pieces, after which he began writing fiction, as if in penance. It is interesting for fiction writers who always alter and reimagine the facts of their lives to watch memoirists get in trouble for doing exactly that. That fiction prompted by the autobiographical is not the same as a memoir seems an idea that is either professionally or commercially inconvenient or just lazily and confusedly lost on many, though seldom on a novelist. Nonetheless, excellent memoirs by novelists abound. Vladimir Nabokov's Speak Memory may be the paragon, or Isaac Dinesen's Out of Africa, or Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast. But there are powerful ones by contemporary fiction writers as varied as Philip Roth, Tobias Wolff, Joan Didion, Mary Gordon, Edmund White, Elizabeth McCracken, and Joyce Carol Oates. Then there are people who, despite doing other things, have made the memoir their brilliant forte. Jill Kerr Conway, Mary Carr, Ruth Reichel, to name a few. This spring, memoirs of bereavement from two young poets who also happen to work in New York publishing have appeared. Festooned with blurbs, these prose works will find their readers and duly move them, for they are candid, questing, and tear-jerking, if necessarily imperfect. Jill Bielowski's slightly mistitled History of a Suicide, My Sister's Unfinished Life, is a bumpy but stirring attempt to get to the bottom of the suicide at 21 of her younger half-sister, who after having been broken up with by a longtime beau, asphyxiated herself in the family garage, with her medicated mother sleeping well into the afternoon upstairs. Kim is discovered by someone else. The book is ostensibly a meditation and investigation. Like most memoirists, Bielowski eschews the word catharsis, since, as she has said when interviewed, catharsis implies a finishing that is nowhere to be found in these pages. It may also be one of the weakest excuses for storytelling. Who wants to read someone else's catharsis? Bielowski's book includes much professional and literary hand-holding in looking slant, let alone straight on, at what will always seem an enigmatic event, the suicide of someone young and beloved. Terms are Googled, experts are written and visited, Shakespeare is quoted, and the book she puts together, part commonplace book, part souvenir album, part emotional laundry list, does not succeed in solving its own puzzles, although it assists the reader in coming away with his or her own ideas. Kim's suicide sits in the lives of Bielowski, her sisters, and her mother, like a murder mystery, and the culprit the book increasingly gravitates toward is not the dozing mom or the dumping boyfriend, who, bizarrely, and with insufficient subsequent exploration by Bielowski, her invocation of Romeo and Juliet feels wide of the mark, committed suicide himself a few years later. Nor does she pay much attention to the blighted Rust Belt landscape, with its depressing culture of erotic and narcotic highs, in lieu of meaningful work. As the book spirals about its various suspects, like the circling of the helix that is the movement of depression itself, the villain who increasingly emerges, or is fashioned, is Bielowski's stepfather, Kim's birth dad, who abandoned the family when Kim was very little, and who once told her she would never amount to anything. Bielowski's own Jewish father died young and left her mother a widow with three young kids. Mrs. Bielowski quickly remarried an Irish-American charmer and bounder. Characterizations here are not detached by Bielowski from ethnicity. With a checked-out mother upstairs and gray, struggling Cleveland outside, not every reader will wholeheartedly agree. Bielowski wants to recognize the forces that weakened Kim's strength and attempt to recreate her inner world through my writing. But this is exactly what it is impossible for the book to do, since it instead illustrates Bielowski's great distance from her younger sister. It is as if she has a refrigerator full of food, but through no fault of her own lacks the stove to cook it on. Bielowski has her own life in New York, full of a survivor's guilty happinesses, but also her own personal tragedies. She is pregnant when Kim dies, and the subsequent loss of the baby takes up much of the book, as it naturally would in real life. Kim's turmoil cannot be explored, and her inner landscape, despite diary and letter excerpts, remains uncreated. When Bielowski looks in her dead sister's closet, she lists, without explication, 14 items of clothing, almost all of which are sexy and black. The exceptions include a Cleveland Browns jacket and the Laura Ashley rose print dress Kim wore as a bridesmaid in the author's wedding. That bridesmaid dress stops the reader. Is it harsh to ask what girl with a black leather miniskirt would want to wear this dress, would feel remotely seen or understood in it, and to wonder what bride would insist on it? Well, too many brides, perhaps. One imagines Kim keeping it in order to sell it on eBay. Elsewhere, the bridal bouquet is also discovered among Kim's belongings, and we see the possible rebuke that flying token might have accidentally bestowed upon her, given all that her older sister's lives contained that excluded her. She surely felt loved by her siblings, but discloses in her own writing feelings of inferiority. Although she was certainly young enough to turn her life around, contagious depression pulled her under, as did impulsiveness and drugs. Kim haunts the book like a sweet ghost, one that is perhaps begging to rest at last in a novel, where such inner lives can indeed be recreated, or at least imagined with specificity. Ironically, the genre of the novel, with its subtle characterizations and rich and continuous dreamscape, remains a kind of gold standard for a genre that may be usurping it. Megan O'Rourke's book about her own personal bereavement following the death of her mother is titled The Long Goodbye, and she is not kidding. Hers is a tour de force et tristesse, especially in its first half, which has all the virtues of a theatrical narrative. Emotional crises, paralysis before the oncoming locomotive of time, a family that is its own ensemble, an ensemble that includes the smart, highly strung eldest daughter, two endearing brothers, the attractive teacher mom and teacher dad. After its dramatic midpoint, with no intermission, the narrative of The Long Goodbye drifts and casts about, just as O'Rourke herself did in the aftermath of her mother's death, as she struggled in the anguish of separation to find the proper and effective rituals of mourning and farewell. A completely acceptable disorganization swirls about the writing, as if in imitation of O'Rourke's restless state, Her mother dies and is brought back to life several times. At one point, it seems that one of the dogs dies twice. The pages proceed intuitively and in a zigzag through the decades. There is once more the googling of grief, literal and metaphorical, emotional processing of every stripe, again the sighting of Shakespeare. O'Rourke aptly prefers Hamlet, though oddly never mentions anything uttered by grief-engulfed Ophelia. The revisiting of childhood memories that are now holier than they need to be, anger at others who are less comprehending. The bereaved cannot communicate with the unbereaved, is her epigraph from Iris Murdoch. And much setting out for long, brisk runs to expel excess tension and get some fresh air. Lecturing and historical exposition sometimes beset the book. The British anthropologist Geoffrey Gorer argues that, at least in Britain, the First World War played a huge role in changing the way people mourned. Its stop-and-start quality can be summed up not just by the epigraph from Murdoch, but also by O'Rourke's quoting of La Rochefoucauld. Death and the sun are not to be looked at steadily. Even the scattering of her mother's ashes for various reasons is done in stages and takes over a year to be completed. The body that I had loved lay in a sandwich bag. O'Rourke's mother Barbara, a beautiful, she is thought to resemble Ally McGraw, and companionable woman of calm vibrancy, beloved by her entire family, is diagnosed with colorectal cancer when she is in her early 50s. Her backstory includes having been her husband's high school student. She was married to him at 17, but the book chooses only to mention this in passing. When Barbara gets the news of her cancer's metastasis to her brain, it is from someone named Dr. Popper, who before he leaves the examination room says, "Yeah, two over on the left side, very unusual, so I'll get Dr. Chi." And then it is the patient's turn to speak. "Well, that was awfully casual of him," exclaims O'Rourke's mother, who soon is in last-ditch experimental treatment with someone named Dr. Nugent. The doctor's names alone cause dread to engulf the reader. Barbara dies at 55, the halfway point of the book. Megan O'Rourke has up until now proceeded with the vitality of a first-rate dramatist, and her mother is a character well-suited to it, equipped with an irrepressible spirit and a Christmas Day death on a bed in the middle of the living room, so that death will be less bureaucratic and fluorescent, breaking the heart of everyone. "I knew that A Christmas Carol would make me cry this season," O'Rourke says later, during the anniversary of her mother's death. "I just didn't know it would be Frosty the Snowman, that least dignified of all carols. I was driving to Trader Joe's on a rainy Sunday to buy poinsettias and eggnog. As I distractedly pressed the radio buttons, I heard the familiar bumptious chorus, and my stomach turned with nostalgia. Thumpity thump thump thumpity thump thump, look at Frosty go. But it was when Frosty, knowing of his imminent demise, tells the kids, 'Let's run and we'll have some fun now before I melt away,' the tears leaked down my face." This is the kind of thing O'Rourke does well, situating her grief amid the absurdities of everyday life. Moreover, she seems to know her mother much better than Bieloski was able to know her sister. And so her mother emerges less as a rough sketch and more as a completed portrait, a lively and memorable person placed as if on a pedestal that is also on a stage. Our mother was a fierce driver. A leased BMW was her one luxury. The summer before she died, Jim came up to Connecticut with me for dinner. He'd just bought a used Audi. "Barbara," he said, "I have to show you something." My mother had just begun her final round of chemotherapy, but she disentangled the chemo purse from her chair and walked haltingly out to the driveway. When she saw the car, she cried out in glee, looked at Jim and said, "We should race." If, like Bieloski's book, O'Rourke's fails to pose some of the larger, impersonal, and unphilosophical questions, O'Rourke's mother and her mother's sister, who both grew up in New Jersey, came down with the same disease and New Jersey's alarming cancer rate is not given a mention, it may seem a missed opportunity, though epidemiology and public policy might disrupt the poetry of bereavement. A reader can long to see eloquent tears made useful. Memoirs often exist precisely for this reason, and their improvised form allows for accommodations of this kind without intruding on any narrative magic. Certainly Bielowski's sister and O'Rourke's mother remain engaging subjects, deserving of the deep imagining, revealing design, and solid construction of heroines in good prose fiction. But real life is messy, and sometimes gracelessly crowds out an enduring story, something no memoir reader necessarily expects. Advocacy of a certain kind can be a memoirist's muse and companion, and in any case is not a guest that will ruin the party. Even Nabokov's canonical Speak Memory does not give us the brilliantly vivid and coherent dreams of his novels, because it simply can't. A third memoir came my way while I was reading these other two. Entitled Dear Marcus, it would seem at first glance to be a fuller demonstration of the democratization of memoir that Neil Gensler so derides. Dear Marcus is a self-published first book by someone with no connection to New York publishing. At the age of 12, its author, Jerry McGill, was shot in the back in Manhattan's East Village on New Year's Day by someone he never saw. He spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair. As with O'Rourke, the anniversary of his tragedy is a holiday, and unlike O'Rourke, he gives himself a treat every year, a fancy meal at a restaurant, a trip to London. His book is subtitled Speaking to the Man Who Shot Me. And since this man was never found, McGill gives him a made-up name and then cries out to him about his life. There is sorrow and fury, but this is not the book of Job. McGill clearly possessed the charm, attractiveness, and spirit to avail himself of the help and care that came his way, both within therapeutic settings and outside, and he managed to have girlfriends, graduate from Fordham University, write screenplays, make films, and subsequently become a teacher and advocate for the rights of the disabled. I personally feel like I am up for this challenge of being a person with a disability, and I have had many wonderful experiences in this role. But it is hard, damned hard. It is not for everyone. I have had tons of disabled friends over the years, and the misconception that we are all strong, inspirational beacons of hope is an immense fallacy perpetrated by and subsisting on images in the media. Nonetheless, although we can list the difficulties he has had with bathrooms, housing, and employment, the powers that be in Hollywood don't think there is a huge market for stories about people with disabilities, despite all the Oscar-winning portrayals that have come from actors playing disabled characters. He also lists, to astonish his invisible assailant, the marvelous globe-trotting pleasures he has experienced, from sipping coffee in a Costa Rican rainforest to performing at a vintage theater in England with a troupe of disabled actors. His book is short, sweet, homespun, and inspiring in the very way that he is skeptical of. He shares with Bielowski and O'Rourke a desire for alternative outcomes. All three books wander in many directions, posing what-ifs, and their authors toughly poke their own wounds and search the sky. One never doubts the psychic injury, but objective criticism in the face of it is like quarreling with a fish. Yet of the three authors, McGill, the African-American man with a bullet lodged in his spine, is by far the most cheerful. As he writes himself, "You can't make this stuff up." 2011. Friday Night Lights. On my way to a Manhattan book party recently, my mind was wandering to cultural guilty pleasures, sprightly but inane movies, or half-baked television programs no sophisticated person would admit to watching, as well as other aesthetic uncoolness, such as, say, Josh Groban, whose precariously belted tenor, crossover repertoire, and passable Italian have made him a secret darling of vulgarians like me. When he sings The Prayer with Celine Dion Is the listener not in the private ocular mists of kitsch heaven? Is not one of those pearly gates real pearl? And might one pay for admission to this slum paradise with a parterre ticket stub from Wozzeck? So it was then with great and satisfying surprise that almost immediately upon arriving at the party, I found myself locked in enthusiastic conversation in a corner with two other writers. All three of us, we discovered, solitary, isolated viewers of the NBC series Friday Night Lights. We spewed forth excitedly, like addicts. This was no longer a secret habit, but a legitimately brilliant drama. Though the title might make the uninitiated think of Shabbat candles, the show is actually about football in Texas, a state that I had felt just then had not been this far east since the Bush administration. Rooting is in our blood, Janet Malcolm has written, and when traveling around this country, one would be hard-pressed not to notice that sports stadiums have become to the United States what opera houses are to Germany. Every community has one, even ones without much money. Friday Night Lights, whose final season has just come to a close, is a weekly hour-long dramatic series, 43 minutes without commercials, whose focus is a high school football team and its place in a particular Texas town by the fictional name of Dillon, inspired by the real-life town of Odessa. In West Texas, largely because of the heat, high school football is often played on weekend nights under Klieg lights to crowds of up to 20,000 people. These lit matches are just that. They light the fuse and transform these young players into local celebrities, turning these high school games into the only show in what would otherwise be a no-show town. In rough terrain blighted further by the dusty winds of economic collapse, droughted ranches, oil rigs mute and still as scarecrows, these games are the week's high point for these boys and for the adults, parents, uncles, unemployed older brothers, boosters, who try to live vicariously through them. The town wants to win at something. The high school coach signs a 2-year contract and often has to look for another job immediately following. If the team loses, the town will remind him by pounding for sale signs into his front lawn or accosting him over ice cream at the local Alamo Freeze. In Friday Night Lights, when the coach's wife takes a job as a guidance counselor to help out, she is told that the last guidance counselor killed herself. Friday Night Lights is held together by a cast of disconcertingly attractive young people with pink, wavy mouths, a few seem straight out of a Beverly Hills casting agency, marring slightly the verisimilitude. They play kids named Tim Riggins, Tyra Collette, Jason Street, Lila Garrity, and Matt Saracen, whose names envelop and suit them better than any others could, including the actor's own. Equally attractive is the only high-functioning family in Dillon, that of Coach Eric Taylor and his wife Tammy, who are played with deep and beautiful concentration and chemistry by Kyle Chandler and Connie Britton. The Taylors often speak politely over each other simultaneously as if in an Altman film, and when they genuinely lose their tempers, which is seldom, it is transfixing, even when the sparring sounds mild. When Tammy is made high school principal and begins to respond to her husband's work issues with platitudes of fatigue, he says, "You know who I miss? I miss the coach's wife." And she replies recognizably, "You know who I can't wait to meet? The principal's husband." The portrait of their relationship has been described by Daniel Mendelsohn as the finest representation of middle-class marriage in popular culture, and it is a far cry from the marriages one has seen on The Sopranos or Mad Men, as well as other marriages in Dillon, Texas. The series wants Dillon to function as a microcosm of larger working and middle-class America. It takes its 50 or so hours and opens a window on American family, education, community race relations, athletics, social class, and its various brokennesses. But lest you go away, it keeps you involved with the drama of high school. Its romantic student soap operas, its tense and dire administrative politics, plus the multi-generational home life that has dads in prison, dads in Iraq, dads gambling and drinking and roaming around the country, while grandma sits in the front room. This is where the role of the coach as Holy Father, not for nothing does he lead the team in prayer before each game, is underscored. These boys are the coach's congregation. He is their shepherd, and they are his flock. And despite its unflinching glance at some really tough lives and an unforgiving landscape, this is a television show and will not submit easily to despair. The same cannot be said of the grim movie off which the series is spun. Both its people and its setting are hard-bitten and haggard. Billy Bob Thornton, as the real-life Coach Gaines, appears pale and grisly, with vampiric, beet-hued lips and stark, hollowing cheekbones. And although Connie Britton here also plays the coach's wife, with her permed 1980s hair and constantly startled expression, she and Thornton look like characters who have wandered off the set of an inexpensive horror film. The panorama of sad houses with for sale signs reads like a chorus crying for long-withheld help, and the desert landscape seems to hunger for a night sky that will cool and be glitterate. The camera work is grainy, quick, and cold, as if the lens could bear neither to blink nor to stare, and the feel and the look of the film are sociological and anthropological, an outsider going by with a crew in a truck. If some residents of Odessa, Texas were not pleased by either the movie or the book on which it was based, its author, the journalist H.E. Bissinger, says he received death threats, it's because no one likes to be told their home is depressing. Everyone likes to think their lives are a little better looking than that. But at the time this movie is set, in the late 1980s, Money Magazine ranked Odessa as the country's fifth worst city to live in. Its racism was legendary. Molly Ivins called it an armpit, and Larry McMurtry's Texasville refers to it as the worst place on earth. Odessa was founded in the late 1800s by huckster land surveyors from Zanesville, Ohio. It never lost the taint of betrayal. Even the high school boys, who are based on real-life people and in the film use those people's real-life names, as opposed to their more innocent fictional counterparts on TV, appear as toughened and worn as the adults are tired and dazed. "We gotta lighten up," says one of the film's football players to his friends. "We're only 17.
"I don't feel 17. "Do you feel 17?
Replies another of the boys, as with deadened eyes they skeet shoot into the Texas sky. In fact, they look leathered and 30, as if all the childhood had been knocked out of them long ago. Set in 1988, when the United States was not involved in any war in the Mideast, the film version of Friday Night Lights was made in 2004, when two such wars were occurring. It is reminiscent of a war movie. The football impact scenes are brutal, and the sound editors have the volume on high for each wince-inducing hit, underscoring the disposability of the boys. "You have to worry about the safety of these kids," one sports announcer says after some bone-cracking tackles. But the subtext, unspoken even in the DVD commentary, is that this is our warrior class. This is where our soldiers come from. The film was made, at any rate, to look that way. It never enters a classroom or has a female character say much of anything. "I don't understand women, and I don't feel comfortable presenting them," says the film's director, Peter Berg, in the bonus commentary. The climax of the film, which is the Texas State Championship game against Dallas's Carter High School, is shot and cut along the same lines as the climax of Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, so says Peter Berg. Although Berg also directed the television pilot, establishing the pace and look of the series, the television show is warmer and greener. It had to be to keep viewers watching for 5 years. There's better music, for instance. Needle Drops by Ryan Adams and by Iron and Wine, as well as many singer-songwriters from the local Austin scene, which gives the feeling of high school life back to the kids. As it was in the film, the Midland, Texas band Explosions in the Sky is also used. In the series, though the homoerotic ties of boys and team sports can be noted and felt, they are not as aggressively put forward. In the film, there is a father-son pair that is the major romance. "You got one stinking year to make yourself some memories," are the father's words of love, and the original edition of Bissinger's book starts off with locker room photographs of hugging teammates and shirtless players blow-drying their hair. The series is more interested than the film in how these boys relate to girls, and although sometimes clueless about the girls themselves, cheerleaders, pageant contestants, and rally girls who often appear doe-eyed, manipulative, attention-starved, and shrill, the rising action written for them requiring rising voices as well. Gender-wise, the series is a substantial expansion on the movie and book. In fact, by comparison, it is a veritable encyclopedia of the female psyche. The mayor of Dillon is a woman, a committed football booster, and lesbian, who, before she began to play for the other team, as it's said in Dillon, once had an affair with Lila Garrity's father, Buddy. And although the first season handed the viewer a world of housewives, cheerleaders, and strippers, their experiences are put forward with sympathy and wit. The TV series, set almost 20 years after the time of the film, also repeatedly dramatizes how the relationship of grown-ups to children in this town. Is it Dillon? Is it Odessa? Is it all of America? Is more often than not flipped. That is, the kids take care of the hapless grown-ups who have stayed on in the down-and-out setting of their own upbringing. It is a sad reversal. There is not one father of a son on the show who is not meddlesome, obstructive, or damaging, and many of the mothers aren't much better. But it's a burden that on television often enlarges rather than diminishes the kids. The series is also shot closer to Austin than to West Texas, so that the look of the land is less desolately lunar than in the film. One feels that the TV show is less about weariness than about the struggle for moral rectitude. The essential goodness of the boys is never in doubt, though the wobbly first season foolishly makes a villain out of a young Katrina refugee. Yet everything about these kids is going to be challenged, if often incoherently, by the various scriptwriters. In real life, teenagers are often challenged to the point of destruction, and even in Berg's film, the boys are, in effect, partly denatured, roughened and distressed to match the parched turf, but less so here in TV land. In this particular primetime representation, small-town Texas culture is less about hardened exteriors and shredded dreams than about preserving, finding, and acquiring integrity and decency. Family duty, Christian kindness, and charity are its hallmarks. For decoration, there is also a lot of cleavage. Unlike The Wire, which works as a visual novel, Friday Night Lights does not possess confident and overarching storylines, and there are so many loose ends and dead stops and panicked plot moves that it might have been written by writers who thought the series was about to be canceled the next day. In fact, there were indeed dire network discussions regarding the program's low ratings. Scripts often seem frantically assembled with no memory of what came before. Story elements are shuffled, parachuted in, forgotten about. People are added and subtracted, and only sometimes is there an imprisonment or a marriage or a baby shower to explain. Often, characters just disappear. It is one of the show's troubling ad hoc aspects, exacerbated perhaps by one of its virtues. The cast had a hand in the dialogue, and often improvised scenes and rewrote lines. Kyle Chandler, script in hand, is said to have once phoned the director to insist, "I don't need to make this speech. I can do it with a look." Chandler can do just about anything with a look. The expressive restraint of his smoldering gaze and his squinted grin of chagrin is one of the most intriguing aspects of Friday Night Lights, even if it is over-relied on. When called on to say lines such as,
I'm offering you everything I got. This is not just about football. I beg of you, think about what I just said. He makes the words pierce and sore. When he says to his team, "Listen up, gentlemen," it doesn't much matter what he actually says afterward. Everyone is drawn to attention. And when at a coach's poker game, he gets up to leave early saying, "I've been cheating all night, looking at his cards, and I still can't beat him." The line reading is such that we know he is actually a bit tipsy and missing his wife. So that is the way the series' chief architect, executive producer Jason Kadams, proceeds. A little willy-nilly. The camera work, three cameras filming simultaneously, is excellent, and done in a run-and-gun filmmaking style, all of which allows the cast additional set pieces, scenes, or ad-libs. But using that many cameras leaves the really hard work of the storytelling to the editors, and having to bring each episode in at 43 minutes clearly resulted in some unhelpful excisions, as well as some dubious inclusions. There is perhaps too much of Tim Riggins's blustery older brother Billy, and too much of the Garrity clan, though Buddy Garrity gets some of the funniest lines in the show, as when, desperate and gasping, he confides to Eric Taylor that the Boosters, a coven of unelected village elders, may have my phone tapped. 2-1, the actors who play the young football players perform with nuance and open-heartedness. Seldom have teenage boys been this emotionally articulate. The distinctive qualities of each one offset the idea of their warrior fungibility as enacted on the team. All are riveting, and their adolescent Texan mumbles, even when explaining the differences between a skinny post and an out-and-up, do not require subtitles, though the thought of subtitles crosses the mind. All the characters say, "Yes, sir," "No, ma'am," "Please," and "Thank you." Sometimes as in, "Becky, shut up, please." The show's handling of race becomes more sure-footed in the later seasons, once Michael B. Jordan, the actor who played Wallace in season 1 of The Wire, joins the cast as the new black quarterback of the East Dillon Lions. Mid-series, even after winning the state championship, Coach Taylor, as punishment by the Politburo of self-interested boosters, is removed as coach of the West Dillon Panthers and sent to the poor side of town to make a team there from scratch. Whereas desegregation for its own sake proceeded with great difficulty in Texas, the gerrymandering of school districts for purposes of football is accomplished in a hurry. And if the redistricting doesn't work, there are always ghost mailboxes that can be set up by the boosters and illegal recruits in the guise of charity. "Feel his hair," says the younger sibling of an African-American girl, touching her sister's white boyfriend's head. "It's like grass." In fact, two characters on The Wire are murdered in David Simon's Baltimore just in time for the excellent actors who play them to join Friday Night Lights, where the boys are not killed, only maimed. One waits for the army to scoop one up, but it doesn't happen until the final montage. The action happens mostly on the football field, and the dramatized football plays, studied on video and in printed diagrams in ring binders by the characters, both male and female. The East Dillon quarterback's girlfriend wants to be a coach, not a rally girl, are more engaging than one might expect. One looks forward to the games, as does every denizen of Dillon, which is what the viewer becomes. Periodically, to end an episode or a season, a wedding or a rodeo is arranged, so we get to see the whole cast gathered up and milling around, as if in a curtain call, to remind us of the community we've come to know. Over the 5 years of the show, there is time for the kids to change, and change they do. By the end, they can all look people in the eyes while speaking. The alcoholic Tim Riggins, brimming with sweet sex and soft rage, reminiscent of a brawny Jim Morrison, begins the show saying of his aggressive tackles, "That dude could be Santa Claus and I'd still hate him. I just like to hurt people." And ends it by turning Panther decency into saintly martyrdom. The good Texan grandson, Matt Saracen, who begins so dutifully and diffidently, becomes an urban Chicago hipster,
And when last we see the endearing albino nerd Landry Clark, before he goes off to Rice University, he is getting an epic lap dance at the local strip joint and in self-parodic tones says happily to the dancer, "I want to know absolutely everything there is to know about you." It would not be entirely accurate to say the entire show was discussed in our mad corner at that Manhattan party. The people I was speaking with mostly wanted to discuss the character Tim Riggins, played by Taylor Kitsch. Kitsch heaven. Lila Garrity was a dismissible minx. Tyra Collette, who runs for class president by saying, "Nobody here is getting laid if you let Ginny here have the prom in the gym," had distracting hairdo instability. The girls, in general, held less interest, and the coach's new baby, Gracie Bell, held the least of all. According to Jason Kadams in the DVD commentary, Gracie Bell is portrayed by a toddler who is one of three twin sisters, a remark that certainly gives one pause. Even Landry Clark and Matt Saracen, and stormy, stalwart Black Irish Eric Taylor, the characters who possess the most forceful gazes, mesmerizing scenes, and unexpected psychological moves in the show, received short shrift. It was the brooding, beautiful, and slightly doomed Tim Riggins, handsome as a statue and bleakly craving goodness, about whom no one could stop talking. Tim Riggins, through the wonders of long form and instantly shareable narrative, he was the realest person in the room. 2011. 9/11/11. Like many people, I watched 9/11 on television from 1,000 miles away. Also, like many people, I found myself asking, among the dozens of terrified questions that crossed my mind, do I know anyone who works in the World Trade Center? I was pretty sure that I didn't, and I was about to relax ever so slightly and guiltily, when I suddenly remembered, wait a minute, that my brother worked there. Or had. He'd been there during the first bombing in 1993, and I wasn't certain whether the state administrative office he worked for was still situated there. It turned out that his office had moved just across the street. My brother was in the World Trade Center subway station when the first tower was hit, and after the second one was hit and the adjacent buildings were evacuated, my brother, covered in ash and unreachable by anyone, walked 8 hours home to Queens. The next day, he returned to work and sat there at his desk for 2 hours waiting for others to show up, until at last it became clear that not a single other person was going to, and so he left. The cough he already possessed became permanently worse. When I think about his returning to his empty office and just sitting there, I like to imagine that it was not out of some heartbreakingly robotic sense of duty that might run in our family, but instead due to the universal human desire to return to the fictional normal. The normal and the everyday are often amazingly unstoppable, and what is unimaginable is the cessation of them. The world is resilient, and no matter what interruptions occur, people so badly want to return to their lives and get on with them. A veneer of civilization descends quickly, like a shining rain. Dust is settled. In the past 10 years, we have done that only sort of. The absurd, brutal cycle of revenge that 9/11 was part of, that all war is part of, has continued. Terrorism is guerrilla war waged by stateless and underfunded communities, or at least the gullible, restless young men within them. Opportunists who wait for acts of war in order to take material advantage of the chaos will quickly set up their schemes and profiteering. They showed up for work, perhaps not the very next day, but soon enough, and the invasion of Iraq ensued, the anniversary of which is less likely to be remarked upon or even precisely remembered. Politics, as David Reif has written, is the ghost at the banquet of any national commemoration. Instead, this year the death of Osama bin Laden was cheered by many members of a generation reared on the good versus evil wizardry of J.K. Rowling.
I recently taught a class of quite brilliant university students, most of whom, when asked to name their desert island book, said Harry Potter, and then good-naturedly debated among themselves which volume was best. They noted, too, that they were the same age as Harry Potter, having begun middle school exactly when he began Hogwarts. I remarked that I was the same age as Osama bin Laden and received some startled looks. I have continued to teach brilliant university students whose desert island discs are hip and arcane, but whose desert island novels are always Harry Potter. A magical Manichaean neo-biblical view of the world might be less possible for those belonging to an older generation, whose desert island book might be, for example, Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory. And so, the death of bin Laden was, in general, treated more soberly by the middle-aged. The new boss, as P. Townsend once said, may be the same as the old boss, and one whiskey priest can be replaced by another. The fierce idealism of younger generations continues in every part of the world, and yet who would want to rid the young of their idealism? It leaves us without even the gruesomely cheering Harry Potter readers celebrating bin Laden's assassination. It would leave us with people even more mysterious and unnerving, who may or may not optimistically show up for work the next day, whose commitment to the resumption of the everyday may be as shaky as terrorism proponents would like it to be. 10 years ago, in the pages of The New Yorker, writers grappled eloquently with the bombing of the Twin Towers, meticulously describing the billowing smoke, the blue sky, the recurrent dreams of flying low through a city. The word cowardly was semantically parsed. Bravery was praised. Middle-of-the-night calls were confessed to, and an intelligent attempt was made to contextualize the event in a longer global history of political tragedy and war conducted in urban streets. Yet what has transpired in the 10 years since 9/11, both here and in the Middle East, was not anticipated by any of these writers, all of whom are paid for their finely tuned imaginations. J.K. Rowling, showing up at her desk in the aftermath, feeling a generation's bolt of lightning scar and imagining a long battle laced with fantasy, may have outwritten everyone. 2011. GOP primary debate. Already in a condition of satire, the opening of the Tea Party-hosted GOP debate on Monday night in Tampa presented the 8 Republican presidential candidates as good-looking characters, the diplomat, the newcomer, the firebrand, who would have to battle one another off the electoral island. Music, brassy intense, and a baritone voiceover let you know that this reality show was part of the ongoing apocalypse light that has infused our television programming and made the networks almost unwatchable. There was little even Jon Stewart on his show the next evening could do to make fun of what was often comedically pre-digested, except to say that the red, white, and blue stage looked like the inside of Betsy Ross's, well, sewing room. I'm paraphrasing. There's always something, if not a lot, to learn by watching a circus. One is both amazed by and sorry for the animals. The clowns are clearly just pretending. The self-pity one arrives with enlarges to become societal. In a certain way, all the candidates on Monday struggled admirably. The Mormons, John Huntsman, Mitt Romney, as well as the Catholic, Rick Santorum, actually knew the words to the national anthem and were the only ones to sing along. They seemed like mama's sweet choir boys. The others, with more husky snark and testosterone, and I do include Michelle Bachmann, did not sing, and nothing in the eyes gave a look of knowing what song it might be or what verse anyone was on. But everyone's hands were on their chests or in anatomically approximate places. Romney may have been clutching his side. His performance next to high testosterone men has not always been good. In 2008, he withered next to John McCain and sometimes looked as if he might burst into tears. He is somewhat more confident now, but similarly dweeb-spirited next to Rick Perry, whose voice is gruffer and lower, perhaps too gruff and low to sing. In the Tea Party audience on the Florida State Fairgrounds, even fewer seem to know Francis Scott Key's words. It is indeed the audiences who are getting scary. The MSNBC crowd last Thursday applauded the